Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Mounds of industrial waste are valuable resources in themselves, if only you could get the minerals and metals out of them. Preston Holloway is a young scientist who just may hold the key to unlocking that treasure. And what's stunting fish in Alberta lakes is the puzzle that Stephen Spencer is trying to solve with his PhD research. And wildlife biologist Dr. Mark Boyce is promoting the use of more sophisticated computer modeling techniques for determining hunting quotas on Alberta's moose, elk, and deer. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One man's garbage is another man's treasure. You might say that motto holds true for Preston Holloway, a young scientist at the University of Alberta, who's developing a new process to recover metals from industrial waste. Preston started his research on the fly ash from oil sands production to recover vanadium. Now, with the help of a studentship award from Alberta Ingenuity, he's moved on to improving the recovery of zinc, nickel, and copper from other piles of waste. His process is called transformational roasting, and it could have significant environmental and economic benefits.
Pretty well every company that operates and recovers metals in the metallurgical industry has usually not just one, but a number of different waste streams, which are somewhere easier to deal with than others. And usually the ones that are easy to deal with, there's economic ways to deal with it, so they're recovering it and making money off of their waste. But it's one of those things, the more complex a material you'll deal with and you're trying to recover metals from, the more types of waste you'll have. So it's pretty large. I mean, we're talking some of the materials we've dealt with. There's one that we're looking at a pile of it that's about 1.5 million tons of material. And so that's a large number. I mean, it's accumulated over 40 years, but still it's a lot just for one plant to have to deal with. So it's one of those things where it often gets overlooked. It's not a lot of research done on it because, it's just kind of sometimes an afterthought to people. But it's something that definitely has some needs out in the industry.
This big pile of 1.2 million tons, where's that?
That's in the mountains in Peru. It's a plant that actually was run by a Peruvian government for about 40 years, and then they got bought by an American company, and the American company is trying to work to deal with some of the environmental issues that are associated with the plant. But it's a slow process. And this particular material is not it's not an environmental hazard in that the metals won't leach into groundwater, but it's just that it's a really big pile of stuff. And so it's something where they look at it and they see a large resource there as far as metals values, but to this point they haven't been able to find a way economically to deal with it.
Where does vanadium fit into this?
Well, the work we did on vanadium recovery from oil sands fly ash was kind of the thing which gave us the idea to pursue this avenue for our PhD research, because the process we developed for vanadium recovery was basically a transformational roasting process, but it's one that people hadn't really looked at the guts of what happened particularly in the waste material and the changes there. And so we looked into that as part of the master's degree and realized that there might be more potential here than a lot of people had given this type of process credit for in the past. So we decided to look in to see how wide of a range of materials this could be used for and what its strengths and weaknesses were by doing a PhD studies with it.
Well, with the vanadium, how does that actually work?
Well, the vanadium process, we get this fly ash from Suncor Syncrude up in Fort McMurray, and then we, in our case, we add just regular salt, heat it up to about 850 degrees, and then what happens is the salt reacts with the vanadium to make all the vanadium water soluble. So you can just dunk the roasted ash right into water, the vanadium all dissolves. And what you're left with is a bunch of vanadium solution that you can recover vanadium from, and a bunch of waste, which we've actually since discovered that might actually, with a little bit of cleaning up, could be saleable as an additive in glass making.
The work that you're doing now, you're looking at zinc and nickel. Where is that coming from?
The zinc and nickel we've been looking at, and mostly with this research, we've basically been or where we've gone with it as far as which materials we looked at has been geared on which companies are willing to donate us materials to be able to work with. So You know, and some companies are more willing to have research done on their materials than others. And so we've had a number of companies, including Doe Run Peru, and Alta Steel in East Edmonton, and Inco in northern Manitoba, donate some materials to look at. And they're ones that they're actively looking at themselves, but we wanted to be able to look at some real materials rather than to just make something synthetic in the lab and try to test that. So we were actually dealing with things that have a lot more complexity than what you would make in the lab.
So how's it working out with the processes that you're working on right now with the zinc, for example?
Well, things have worked out fairly well to this point. We've regularly been able to get higher than 95% zinc recovery, and much of the work since has been looking at the recovery of some of the other minor elements like indium or gallium or silver that are also valuable, or looking at trying to make residues that are more disposable. So it's worked out fairly well. Now, whether it's as good or better than what is currently existing and what the industry uses, that's something we'd have to test out economically. And so I'll do that. Part of that as part of the PhD thesis, but at this point, that's still a little up in the air.
So once it goes through this transformation, can you then recover those materials and use those metals again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what we do after we've heated it and this transformation has occurred, the objective is to get it so those metals are more recoverable. So in most cases, so far, it's meant that those metals are then readily leachable. So we can dissolve them in either water or in a dilute acid. So then we can basically mix the stuff when it comes out of the furnace and with water or acid, and we get metals out in solution that we can recover using very conventional methods, and then we can deal with the waste from there. So there's a possible opportunity with this. There's other methods, things like magnetic separation or electromagnetic separation, which are possible too, but the materials we looked at, haven't been necessary.
What makes your process so different then from what's gone on before?
Well, most processes, particularly for waste recovery, have focused on either one of two types of methods. In extractive metallurgy, there's two kind of main streams, which they are called pyrometallurgy, or the recovery of metals using fire or temperature, and the other case where it's hydrometallurgy, which is recovery using water or basically dissolving things in acids or bases and the like. And this is kind of it's trying to use the synergistic aspects of the both sides of this, because in a lot of cases you can often get very high recoveries with pyrometallurgy, and the processes are generally quite quick, but also sometimes can be quite energy intensive. In the case of hydrometallurgy, you have things that are perhaps maybe a little less energy intensive, but generally you can have residues come out of that which are environmentally aren't always very disposable. So we're trying to look at using the two ends, the good points of both types of metallurgy to get this process to work.
When you look at these piles of waste that are left over from industrial processes, how much metal might actually be in those wastes that would make it even worth recovering?
Well, it becomes an economic issue. It depends how big the pile is and how rich it is in the various metals. But you look at the million plus tons in Peru. I mean, there's over 200 million tons of zinc in that material, and that's that's a lot of zinc. I would put it almost $200 million in value at current prices. So it's something where you have a significant resource. It's just, as with all engineering, it comes whether you can actually get it out economically or not.
Any challenges to overcome at this point?
Oh, yeah. I mean, nothing's ever perfect. We have a few things that which compete with each other. I know in our the copper nickel work we've been doing, we're still finishing off that, but we've had great nickel recoveries, great copper recoveries. We've been able to keep all the sulfur from going into atmosphere. However, it has some arsenic in it as well. And the arsenic, we can't always get to do what we want to do to this point. So the nice thing with this type of process is that if we design it properly, we have a chance to add one or more different additives to affect the way that different elements report in the system.
You're heading off to Texas. What are you going to do down there?
Well, we're presenting a paper at the TMS conference in San Antonio in March, and we're basically presenting just an introduction to this type of process and just trying to explain what we're trying to do, give a few results just to show what kind of things are possible. and hopefully to try to get some response from industry to say, to have them say, well, you know, if it's a good idea, bad idea, give ideas, that type of thing when we go down there.
Well, good luck down there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Preston Holloway, a PhD candidate in chemical and materials engineering at the University of Alberta. His research is supported by Alberta Ingenuity. Alberta has very few lakes compared to other provinces. It also has an ever-increasing number of anglers as more and more people move into the province. So there's a lot of pressure on what's left of our fishery. Stephen Spencer is a fisheries biologist with Alberta Sustainable Resource Development, and he's a PhD candidate in renewable resources at the University of Alberta. Stephen is investigating why the fish in some lakes seem so small. Is their growth stunted, or are they simply not getting a chance to mature?
A few years ago, we had some pretty wide-scale collapses of our fish populations. But in the late 80s and 90s, there was work to address that problem, and very restrictive regulations were brought in. And we've seen some really, really big successes as far as our fish populations.
Now, one of the issues that you're dealing with is something called fish stunting. What's that?
Some of our populations have recovered quite nicely. We've got huge increases in the number of fish that people are catching. The problem is on some of the lakes, the fish have remained quite small, whereas they used to get quite a bit larger. So the concern is, why aren't the fish getting larger? And the two competing theories that we're working on is, one, the fish are stunting, which is basically reduced growth at age, or we still have a high harvest problem. We've got still lots of anglers, plus we've got really increased catch rates. So by cycling through a lot of fish, perhaps we're still having a lot of mortality on the fish.
So in essence, the fish could either be small because they're young, or they could be older but small because something's keeping them smaller. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that would be accurate.
So you've been collecting data on this for the last 3 years, and you've designed an experiment to deal with it. What was your experiment?
Well, working with anglers, we decided to change the size limits on four different lakes to either increase harvest or decrease harvest. And so we wanted to reduce the numbers of fish in some lakes to see if it was a stunting problem from competition for food, or we'd increase the size limits to reduce harvest on these lakes to see if it was an over-harvest problem.
So how did you actually go about it? Did you have anglers helping you out?
Oh, yeah. We've got a crew of volunteers that have been hugely helpful with this project. And so we initially needed estimates on the number of fish in each lake, and from there we had public meetings to change the regulations, and then we followed the populations after we changed the regulations to see the changes.
So were the anglers actually catching the fish for you?
Oh yeah, there was a lot of participation, which really helped with the outcomes. By changing the regulations, that it didn't take a lot of work to get increased interest in the fisheries with more relaxed regulations. There was harvest opportunities and good fishing, and so we got a lot of people out to those fisheries, and it worked quite well. The anglers were very helpful in the angling surveys that we had. After a day of fishing, we would have people at the docks to measure the fish, and anglers would report on how good the fishing was and provide their fish for analysis.
So you'd actually measure them right there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we take an aging structure, and that was very helpful.
What did you find from all of this then, once you started putting all that information together?
Well, it became very obvious that the harvest on the lakes where we provided more opportunity was quite significant. We saw a lot of fish coming out very quickly, whereas on the lakes where we reduced the harvest, made it more difficult to catch fish over the size limit, we saw a real reduction in angler use, and very few fish were harvested.
Now, what impact would that have then on the size of the fish?
Well, on the population level, because we went with a minimum size limit, so fish only over a certain size, very quickly the fish over the size limit were cropped down to the size limit. So this population got smaller on average on the lakes where we had more harvest.
Now that you've got all of this information together, what are you going to do with it in order to finish up your PhD?
Well, this fits back into our broader knowledge of fish populations in the province. And so we'll use this information to examine other management methods to not structure the population. So we have a range of sizes because that's more desirable on many different levels, an ecological level, on biological level, social level. People like catching big fish. So we want to not structure these populations so much. And then from there, I'd like to do a modeling exercise to bring it to a landscape level to evaluate how fishing affects populations throughout the province.
So it really comes down to then being an angler issue, that the more you catch, the smaller the fish are going to be. Is that it? Have I got it right?
Well, the problem with our fisheries to date is we've got open access to them, and we've seen huge increases in the number of people in the province, and unfortunately we don't have any more lakes. So that's part of the problem, is things are changing, and we have to adapt to that.
So your work then is going to have pretty immediate significance in terms of what kind of management rules are going to be put in place. Do you see that?
Well, there will certainly be some recommendations out of this work, and from there we'll see how that fits into the management schemes. But that's my hope, that this will be very useful for our management in the province.
Is there anything that you found surprising in the work that you were doing and in the things that you found going through these surveys?
Well, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more of a growth response from the fish. I thought it would have been a combination of harvest and perhaps a little bit of stunting from huge increases in numbers of fish, but I was a little disappointed to see that there wasn't more of a biological response from the fish to the change in densities.
What happens now?
Well, I have a lot of work to write this all up and analyze the data and come up with some ideas on where we go for next as far as management options from this. But that will be very interesting, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was Stephen Spencer, a PhD candidate in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. His research is supported in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. Alberta is known for its wilderness and its big game like moose, elk, and deer. Every year, the government sets quotas on how many animals can be hunted. Dr. Mark Boyce holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alberta. He's developed a new computer modeling program that could vastly improve the current methods of setting wild game quotas.
Well, every area biologist uses a different method for deciding the quota for his or her particular WMUs, wildlife management units. Sometimes it's just a seat-of-the-pants approach to looking at previous harvests and observations in the field as to whether numbers seem to be stable or not. And no very sophisticated method for optimizing the harvest. In other cases, there are some crude models that are being used to set quotas, but for the most part, we're not taking advantage of the new simulation methods that have been developed for harvest optimization.
So it's still fairly rough in a day and age when we're going more and more towards computer modeling. You've been working on some computer modeling. What have you been doing here in your office?
Well, we've been developing models that use exactly the sorts of data that the biologists might have access to, such as composition data, that is the proportion of fawns and does and bucks in a population, that would use the aerial survey data, would use information about variation from year to year in how severe the winter might have been, and would use hunter harvest data obtained in cooperation with the Alberta Fish and Game Association through telephone surveys. So those are the sorts of data that the biologists have available. And what we've been doing is to develop models, computer simulation models, that take advantage of exactly those data to allow the biologists to explore alternative harvesting schemes. For example, would you increase the number of females harvested in an area? Or what if you were to reduce the number of permits allocated for males or females? What would the consequences be for population? What would be the consequences for the long-term sustainable yield out of the herd?
Are there any gaps in your information?
Well, we always have gaps in information. We have winters like this winter where there's no snow, and it makes it impossible to get a good aerial survey for estimating population size. We have gaps of information, not knowing what the Métis and Aboriginal harvest might be in a particular area. We have limited information about predators and their influence on big game populations in certain areas. So those are challenges to putting together effective harvest modeling designs so that we have reasonable ways for accommodating these gaps in our information, dealing with uncertainty in the system.
Well, how do you deal with uncertainty?
It depends on what kind of uncertainty it is. When we're talking about climate data, we have to presume that historical records will give us some inkling of what the future is going to hold. That becomes more and more challenging as we see climate change, which is more difficult to predict than in the past when the conditions were fluctuating around some long-term average. We have information from conservation officers, for example, about the relative amount of Aboriginal and Métis harvest in an area. We have information from local trappers about the abundance of various predators within a WMU. So we can use these relative qualitative pieces of information to scale our models and to come up with alternative harvesting strategies based upon certain conditions that are presumed to exist on the land base. Using computer simulation, it allows us to explore what the consequences of varying some of those parameters might be. For example, if we're really clueless as to how much Aboriginal and Métis harvest there might be in an area, we can explore a particular assumption, and if the data just don't line up with those assumed harvest levels, one can adjust the harvest levels accordingly until the data do line up, until all of the inputs are consistent. And that allows us to explore some of the uncertainties.
What's happening in terms of integration of the models that you're developing and the system that's in place now for the government to set harvest quotas?
Well, in July of 2005, the province of Alberta implemented the Wildlife Management Information System, which is a new Oracle database that allows the biologists from throughout the province to store in a central location all of the information that they collect from the field, as well as the hunter harvest data, as well as the aerial survey data, all in one central location, so that the data can be immediately downloaded onto their office computers for analysis. One can also draw information from adjacent WMUs and adjacent herds for comparison with a particular WMU, wildlife management unit, of interest. So it's a tremendous advance to have all of these data in a central location, and that's part of the motivation for our wanting to assist the province in developing simulation methods so that one can take maximal advantage of these data that will be increasingly used for setting seasons and quotas for hunters.
This has been an ongoing process, and there have been a number of groups involved. Who's playing a part in all of this?
There are a number of partners. Of course, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Ministry of Sustainable Resource Development, is the principal organization that's involved in that's who sets quotas for harvest. And the biologists, area biologists working for Fish and Wildlife will be the ones who will use the models that we're developing. But of course, it's the hunters in the province who will be the beneficiaries of having improved models for setting quotas and allocations for big game permits. And of course, there are a number of organizations that are very interested in seeing this done as best possible, and that includes the Alberta Professional Outfitter Society, APOS, the Alberta Fish and Game Association, and Safari Club International, and the Alberta Conservation Association. These various partners contribute in various ways. We've received funding for our project, as well as data that are collected using funds provided by Alberta Conservation Association and APOS. Aerial surveys, for example, are funded by those two organizations. Alberta Fish and Game Association is actively involved in running the telephone survey that's used to collect information on the hunter harvest.
Everyone got together for a meeting the other night. What is the next step, then, in this process of developing this model and getting it used?
Well, part of the motivation for our meeting was to make sure that we understood how best to interface the models that we're developing with the new wildlife management information system and to inform the partners involved with the project as to the progress on the project. So I think we have a much better understanding after our meeting about how we will be able to develop web-based models that can interface very seamlessly with the wildlife management information system and to develop models that work very efficiently for biologists in working in their respective area offices, so that they can sit in their office and download all of the data that are necessary to explore these models and try various scenarios that they probably would never dream of trying in the field, because they might be such radical departures from current management. But on a computer, it's very easy to explore a variety of different harvesting strategies and see what works best.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Mark Boyce. He holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Calgary Technologies, Inc., the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Innovation and Science, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.